Welcome to the Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I originally thought I wanted to do this podcast simply to better understand who our public servants are and what drives them, so that we can see them as fully human and honor their service and sacrifice. What I see now is that I'm also trying to wrap my mind around who we are as a nation through a deeper understanding of the people who come from all over America to serve this country. I think we're in the middle of a national identity crisis, and maybe it's not so much about political party as it is about coming to terms with all the space between who we are and who we aspire to be. So who are we? Let's take it one person at a time. I have been so privileged in my life and career to meet some really fascinating people who've dedicated some portion of their own lives to public service. And today, I am sitting down with my friend, Jill. Jill started her civil service journey as a presidential management fellow. She worked in disaster response, programming to advance women's empowerment, and most recently in conflict prevention. Prior to joining the federal government, Jill worked for nearly 15 years in design and marketing for well-known brands. So my first question is usually, did you set out to become a civil servant? But Jill, it sounds like that wasn't the case for you originally. So please tell me, how did you end up on this path?
Thanks, Kate. I have to start by saying how excited I am to be here with you. Thanks for this opportunity to share my story.
You know you were the first person I called because our conversations are always so entertaining. And I think we've been denying the public the privilege of listening to our wild tangents. So I'm so happy to have you on.
I hope that folks find this entertaining because I know when I sit down with you, I come away feeling so energized and delighted. So hoping we can carry that into this conversation. So as you said, I come from a very unconventional background, I would say, in terms of what I have seen among civil servants who I have worked with. I know there will be folks out there who also had non-linear journeys to the civil service. But it really took me by surprise, I think, that I ended up in the federal government. So I worked, as you said, for over a decade, close to 15 years as a graphic designer. And I did that for major brands and always in the private sector. I know there are graphic designers throughout the federal government working as civil servants, but I always did this work internally, generally, for companies. I was an in-house graphic designer. And I pursued that career initially because it was pretty simple. I liked to draw and I wanted to honor a skill set that I felt I could share with folks, hopefully make some money doing it, and just wanted to feel satisfied in my daily work. What I realized eventually is that, oh, there is an entire career field where you can specialize in drawing, and that is a commercial illustrator. Did not know that when I was 18, 19 years old. Instead, I studied art and graphic design in undergrad and kind of found myself on this conveyor belt of a career that just meant I was working in Photoshop all the time. The job was very much about supporting brands so that they could maximize profit. And it was a lot of creative problem solving. I worked with some really wonderful folks. And I knew pretty quickly, though, into that career that it wasn't going to be something that would satisfy me long term. And simultaneously to that, as I was figuring out what my next step might be, my husband joined the Navy, which is a whole other story unto itself, speaking of public service. But when he joined the Navy, it meant that suddenly I was a military partner and I was going to be moving around in support of his career. And I will admit that was a struggle for me initially because I had not grown up in a military family. I didn't know what that was going to look like. But the graphic design career that I had developed to that point was one that was very portable, and it meant that I could continue working everywhere that we went. And really, when my husband joined the Navy, it was kind of my first exposure to true public service, because the lifestyle that comes with military service is, I likened it to like the Twilight Zone. So we were like civilians one day, and then we got dropped into this other system that was the military. And, you know, the thing that always cracked me up was just going to a pharmacy, for example. When you're a civilian, when you're not in the military, you have your local pharmacy you go to pick up whatever it is you need. You go to CVS. If you've spent your entire adult life in the military and you're used to going to a pharmacy on a Navy base, you may not know that there are actually pharmacies out in town that you can go to. And I say that because we had a friend in the Navy who called me one day and said, I need to pick up a prescription, but I don't know where to do this. Like, there's not a Navy base nearby. But the experience was shocking in that you're living kind of a parallel existence in a system that's meant to provide a lot of support to the folks who are going to be in service to the U.S. by essentially choosing a career path that is the military.
Did your husband actually come from a military family, or was it a new experience for him too?
He had folks in his family who had served, and he also grew up in an area that had a lot of military folks. And I think similar to my experience, he found himself joining the Navy at a time in his life when he had pursued another career for some time and decided that that he was in financial services, financial management, and he decided this is not going to be something that's going to serve me. And I think it's similar to the experience I had. You reach a point maybe in one career and you're looking for something that's going to bring you a little bit more, I don't know, personal satisfaction or a sense of, I don't know,
purpose
and greater connection. And he found himself joining the Navy. And anyway, I know I'm taking forever to get to this.
No, I love your stories. I love your stories. Please.
So he's in the Navy. We're moving around. We end up in the Middle East for a couple years. And it was an accompanied tour, meaning that I could go with him. And so we're living in the Middle East, and I really wanted to maximize my experience of living there. And while I was still working as a graphic designer remotely, I found a volunteer opportunity with an organization that was supporting survivors of sexual violence. And this meant sexual assault, and it also meant intimate partner violence, which I think folks also might know as domestic violence. And that experience was just mind-blowing. You know, you're basically trained to sit with folks in the kind of aftermath of trauma and support them as they are grappling with what comes next. Unfortunately, where we were living at the time in the Middle East, there weren't a bunch of services that folks could rely on. It was also a country that is authoritarian, not favorable to human rights organizations, not favorable to gender equality or, you know, women's rights. And so while the experience was one that really introduced me to public service kind of on an individual level by supporting folks in their trauma, I also wondered if there were opportunities to improve that service and what that might look like. And so when we returned to the U.S. And my husband got out of the Navy, I did similar volunteer work, but with a U.S.-based organization. And in that role, I was going to what are called medical forensic exams. And this was in California. What happens in a medical forensic exam is following an incident of sexual assault. If folks want to have the option to pursue any kind of, you know, criminal justice in the future, it requires, I think in many cases, that you gather evidence. And this is done through this medical forensic exam. And so I would be there to support the person while they were going through a really challenging process. There would usually be forensic nurses and law enforcement there as well. And my takeaway from doing that work in the US was that there's a whole legal framework and resources put toward this kind of support. And that I wanted to understand a little bit more about how we might broaden that support everywhere, you know, not just in California. And it's not to say that how it's done in California is perfect either. I don't think that it's a one-size-fit-all solution. But this inspired my decision to go to grad school. And then I ultimately was a fellow in a fellowship program called the Presidential Management Fellowship Program. And I pursued that after grad school. And that was my entry into the federal government. I have since now worked for two different federal agencies. And I think I have in my short time in the government, it's been a few years now, I think I have a pretty holistic understanding of what civil service looks like. Understanding, though, that there are lots of federal agencies out there doing lots of really good, important work. And I've had the privilege of just seeing a couple of those agencies. But
they are very different federal agencies, too, I will say. I think you've had, like, really a really diverse set of experiences, which I imagine has only empowered you to be a more effective contributor.
That is so kind. I hope so. I do think that something I've seen, which is interesting, I've worked for a federal agency that's focused on domestic work, and mm-hmm. I've also worked for a federal department that's focused on international work. Mm-hmm. And I think there are lessons from both of those spaces that can inform how we can better serve not just the American people, but also kind of the global community. I appreciate you pointing that out, because I often think that my background is already so wonky that it's hard for me to make sense of how things can support each other and align, and like, what is the through line in all of
this?
Yeah,
but I was just thinking the word through line. And I mean, I think, you know, with telling the story of your career, it can be challenging, and it is sort of an art coming up with what that through line is and how to tell that story. But the reality is, like, we're human beings, and we are kind of just a collection of our experiences and our impressions of those experiences. And so maybe it doesn't all have to kind of align neatly. Maybe it's just that certain experiences that you have are going to come up and become a really meaningful part of how you react to something 20 years later. And you cannot even predict how that's going to be the case. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I certainly do. Because I think that's happening to me all the time. Yeah. And especially right now with everything that's going on, I have feelings coming up in me that I haven't felt. And I'll probably talk about this a little bit. I haven't felt since I was very early in my graphic design career. There's so much uncertainty. And it is comforting to know, like, once you're faced with some level of uncertainty or discomfort, that you do have some prior experience you can tap into.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I think of this kind of in terms of parenting, too, because I'm raising three kids and trying to, like, help them learn to build resilience. And my favorite, child psychology expert, parenting expert, Dr. Becky Kennedy, who has this book called Good Inside and a podcast by the same name. She talks a lot about how her definition of resilience is your tolerance for discomfort, your ability to actually be in the uncomfortable space. And I think a lot of times we think about it as overcoming, or we think of resilience as like the moment when you've defeated a challenge. But in reality, it's actually the ability to sit in the discomfort and know that you're going to be okay. Yeah. And I feel like that is, you know, what we are all kind of doing at this moment.
Yeah.
I'm trying to reassure each other.
Oh, yeah. I love that definition. I'm going to have to look up. I'm not familiar with her work, but it's funny you say that. I often find, like, if I learn about child development, child psychology theories or best practices, like, even as an adult, I'm like, That's great. Like, let me apply that to myself.
Totally.
Right now.
Like, the whole secret about parenting is that 90% of the work is actually fixing yourself.
Yes.
And then in the process, like, hopefully your kids are better off. But, like, I think Dr. Becky calls it reparenting. Like, you have to finish raising yourself and undo some of the harmful patterns in your own life.
Ooh,
and
yeah,
it is such hard work.
Yeah.
But it's true. Every time I'm reading something to try to figure out what's going on with one of my kids, I'm like, oh my gosh, I was a deeply feeling kid.
I love that phrasing, deeply feeling kid.
Yeah.
That's really,
you know, I think sweet. A lot of us who choose careers that are oriented toward serving, healing, giving back are deeply feeling kids. Don't you think?
I think so too. I think that's true. And I have found that with so many folks that I've worked with. And it's not to say that I don't think it's true in the private sector as well, but I've been overwhelmed by the humanity inside the government.
And the resilience.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Me too. And I think that's why this project has actually been something that has been swirling in an incomplete state in my mind for years. Because the more people that I had the privilege of meeting in government, the more inspired I felt and the more reassured I felt kind of about our future and the possibilities that could exist.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh my gosh, these are overwhelmingly wonderful human beings. And so for me at this point, I feel like I'm privileged to be able to just provide a forum where people can tell their stories.
I love that.
And so
grateful to you, Kate.
I'm grateful to you. While we're talking about resilience, then I'm wondering if you can share with me an event in your life that's shaken your faith in yourself or your path.
I certainly can. I mean, I'm someone on the topic of deeply feeling. I think I pretty regularly have like micro events that shake my faith in myself. And I think it actually all stems from a very early, at least in my professional life, there was an early experience in my professional development that I think I'm only just now realizing how deeply I was impacted by it. At the time, I think I was maybe fairly dissociated through the whole event. But it would have been my very first job out of undergrad. So I was quite young. You know, I was in my early 20s. And I went to work for a small kind of boutique graphic design company. And the owner of the company was my boss. And I don't need to spend a lot of time on the details, but it was a toxic environment. This particular person, owner of the company, was just a serial sexual harasser, emotionally abusive. This was all happening at least a decade before the Me Too movement kind I think provided a platform or a space for folks to share their experiences with even just low level harassment, just the way that we engage with folks. But what I was experiencing, I think rose to a level that was like sufficiently traumatizing, and it just left me feeling so inadequate early in my career. And I actually think what happened is that I knew early on that graphic design wasn't going to be something that I wanted to pursue forever, and that there was probably something else out there that if I had the time to explore, I might actually find it. But something happened inside of me, and I don't know if this is actually healthy resilience, but I was determined to make my graphic design career meaningful. And if it meant taking more jobs and kind of building back my confidence that I could be good in that career field, despite what this early supervisor would have had me think of myself, I think I ended up sticking it out in that first career at least 5 years longer than I should have, probably longer. And, you know, something that I have to say to tie this back to the civil service, at least in my experience, and I know this won't be for everyone because there are, you know, there are bad apples all over the place, but I think I was really worried when I was starting a new career in the civil service that I was going to be kind of in a one down position again, where I was, you know, admittedly much older than I was coming out of undergrad, but that I would be in a power dynamic where if someone wanted to be abusive to me, it might be easier for them to do that because I was basically a, you know, a junior officer, junior employee entering a new organization. And I had a lot of, I think, just anxiety in me that I wasn't aware I had carried until I was getting ready to embark on this new career in the civil service. And what I found was I was incredibly lucky. My team that I landed in as a presidential management fellow, it was a healing experience. They were incredibly supportive. My boss, I mean, I could just cry thinking about this person. He was so incredible and so supportive. He's remained incredibly supportive, even though I don't work for him anymore. And I think that, you know, there are places in the private sector that can develop folks in a way that they are empathetic leaders. Mm-hmm. I do think the civil service has structure, and when done well, there are policies in place that make it possible for folks to kind of become the best possible version of themselves as a leader. And I benefited from that as an employee, but also as someone who really needed to heal from an early experience as a professional that just left me feeling like I was inadequate.
Isn't it wild how, like, we can go through these experiences and in the moment you're in kind of survival mode?
Yes.
And so you don't fully process it, and it can take years, before you return to a trauma to fully process it. So I'm so happy that you had a healing experience.
Thanks, Kate.
I mean, you deserve all the good things. And I think by also, you know, how they say hurt people, and also healed people, heal people. I know from knowing you and knowing how you work that you also go around healing people all the time.
Oh gosh, so Kate, that's so sweet.
You're paying it forward.
I sure hope so, because I will say, I kind of live in fear of like unwittingly hurting someone, because some of what I've experienced with people who, like you say, they're hurt. They're hurt, and now they're hurting someone else. I think there have to be cases where people aren't aware that they are in pain, and they aren't aware of how that is externalizing. And I often think, you know, what am I missing about myself? What have I not processed yet that I might be unwittingly putting out in the world? But yeah, all this to say, I'm grateful that I had an experience, and I've continued to have this same experience as a civil servant that has been, it's helped me to redefine myself in the workplace and as a person, which has been a gift, really.
That's amazing. And I think, I don't know if I'm remembering correctly, but I think that the first time we met at a training, we sat down and had lunch together, because we both were doing like the awkward, oh, can I sit at this table? Oh, sure. And we sat down and had lunch together. And I think we talked about our imposter syndrome.
Yes.
And how we knew, like, we knew that we shouldn't feel that way, but still we were struggling with it. And part of it was just because in the work, in the work that we've been exposed to, like, there are so many brilliant people that you encounter.
Yep.
And it can be intimidating at times. And I've found that that voice still comes up all the time.
Yeah.
And I've just gotten a little bit better at, like, telling it to sit down.
Yeah. I also think what you said earlier also resonates with me. It's telling that imposter syndrome, that voice, to sit down. I think it's also, for me, recognizing that I'm really uncomfortable when I hear that voice and just kind of letting it wash over me. Like, yeah. Yep, I'm going to feel a little icky right now.
Yes, because you are practicing resilience. Yes. Dr. Becky would be so proud of you. Dr. Becky, if you're listening, look at how resilient we are being.
I can't wait to look up Dr. Becky. I think
part of my healing journey. She's like my hero. So if she's listening to this, I've made it. And I'm so happy. I am sort of curious. I was going to ask you a different question next.
Yeah.
But I want to skip it because I really want to get to this one about regret. I haven't had the chance to ask anybody this question yet.
Ooh, yeah.
Do you believe in regret?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Do you have a philosophy around regret?
I think I've developed one over time. It's a little messy, so I hope I'm conveying it in a way that's helpful.
I'll edit you if I have to.
Okay. Cool. So I do believe in regret. I have felt, I think, a healthy, normal amount of regret. I say healthy and normal because I think it's an unavoidable human experience. I think it's, I've read it framed this way and I've experienced it this way myself. I just think regret is part of existential dread. I think it's just...
You are like a French philosopher right now. Go on.
I know. I don't want to sound like like I've actually done any significant reading on this or I'm in any way an expert. I just know that I have, for most of my life, grappled with existential dread. It's mm-hmm. just kind of part of my ongoing.
Because you're a deeply feeling kid.
I'm deeply feeling. And it did. It started when I was a kid, this sense of like, what does it all mean? Where are we going? What's the point? And as I've gotten older, what I've figured out is that regret is kind of an unavoidable part of that experience. Because if you have a sense of your own, of time, you have a sense mm-hmm. of time and how finite time is, there will naturally come with that, I think, a worry about how am I spending my time?
I get that. I feel that actually all the time. So I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I feel comforted knowing that's human. This is mm-hmm. this is human. I think what I've had to do for myself, and really this came from the experience of having one career and worrying that I had taken too long to make a big jump to a new career. And I was worried about future regret. I wasn't actively regretting that I hadn't done this other thing, but I was worried that in the future I would regret that I hadn't done it. And I took that in as data, and I think eventually got to a place where I saw it as an opportunity for creativity. I think where I've landed now is I don't like to give regret any more power than is necessary. I don't think it needs to be pointless. I think if you have a sense of future impending regret, that can spur you to action. And so I try now as much as possible to make embodied decisions, like mm-hmm. be present, come back to the things that I really care about and try to use that as the foundation for what I'm going to do next. I will say that is increasingly challenging right now as a civil servant, trying to make decisions that are going to mitigate regret, because I think as all of us look at what's happening, I know for myself, I kind of thought this was it. I thought I had made a career jump. I found the civil service to be kind of exactly what mm-hmm. I had been looking for. It was a space where humans were coming together in service of other humans. And that felt really good to me. Never mind that there are some things that need working out. As always, it mm-hmm. is, you know, the project of American progress and how we organize ourselves. Like, that's always going to require a lot of tweaking. But I believed that I had found my space and my people. And now that some of that or most of that is being called into question, it's really challenging to avoid fear of future regret or worry about future regret. But the only other thing that I try to tell myself, I read this years ago about regret, is if all you do is spend your time worrying about how you're going to feel in the future, you're not actually giving your future self enough credit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, your future self is probably even more resilient and better prepared than you are right now, because other things have come up that will prepare you to take on that future regret, if it happens at all. And so I like the idea of seeing myself kind of moving into the future. There's some version of me that's actually really well adapted.
Think about how much stronger this today version of you is,
for sure,
compared to 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
Of course, it's true.
Yeah.
And also, I'm so glad I asked you the regret question, because you struggle with existential dread. So you're the perfect person to answer it. And you know, if it helps, I think what I try to remember, I think gratitude is the antidote. I mean, for so many things.
Yeah.
But I think when I'm in a space of gratitude, it helps put regret into context.
Yeah.
And I can say, you know, I'm grateful for the experience that I had. I'm grateful that I'm here now. I'm grateful that I picked up all the lessons along the way. And I, you know, forgive everything else. Like, even if
yeah,
I think it took
beautiful.
Me too long to reach a certain place, apparently it had to take that long. That's how long it took.
I love that you just said that, because I think that's the grace that a lot of folks need. Really, it needs to come from you. Like, the individual has to provide that forgiveness, that it's just going to take as long as it's going to take. The other thing, along with gratitude, because I've been reflecting on that too in this current moment, the other word that keeps coming up for me, and I think it relates to regret, there's so much grief right now.
Yes.
Just grieving, you know, on every level, grieving for the whole world, grieving for the U.S., grieving for, and, you know, not making this political, but just there are big changes happening that are having big impacts,
mm-hmm.
and the world is starting to look like it could be a different version. And that mm-hmm. just comes with grief. And I do think, I think for me, the real core of regret, worrying about regret, is actually worrying about grieving. It's
mm-hmm.
being afraid of a grieving process. I don't think there's any harder for me, any harder emotion than grief.
And I don't think that you can get through life without it. So
right.
It's kind of unavoidable.
It's unavoidable.
Which is awful.
Yeah. And so I think I find the more that I name it, like I talked to my current boss a couple weeks ago, and I said something about how, you know, we're all kind of grieving, and I don't think that had occurred to him just yet. And it really seemed to, like, actually lift. So I don't want to give myself too much credit here, but he seemed to indicate that just by naming the grief, it lifted something from him that maybe was helpful. So I don't know. I know that's a tough one. Grief is hard for people. I think we shy away from it. So that's okay too.
But it's also transformative.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, at the top of this episode, when I tried out a new intro, I talked about the fact that I think we're obviously in a moment of a lot of change.
Yeah.
And change can be really painful. And I think I actually have long perceived or had this sense that we were like in an adolescence as a country.
Ooh, yeah.
I actually remember thinking this when I was literally an adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this country has like the same vibes I have going on. This country is going through it. And
it's
I feel
angsty.
Like, I mean,
it's
so angsty, and we're a young country. Like, in the timeline of countries, it makes sense that we'd be going through an adolescence and trying to figure out who we are. And, you know, we're punk rock one day and we are hipsters the next.
Yep.
And so I think what is going on is the painful kind of pendulum swinging back and forth. And we're trying to figure out who we are. And I think we are also struggling with what I mentioned at the beginning, that distance between like how we think of ourselves and who we are. Or I've also heard it referred to as the difference between our interests and our values. And I've always found that really interesting and problematic.
It is.
And I found it problematic like when I was in the policymaking community, because those are the terms we're dealing in every day.
Yep.
And I think there is this assumption that there will always be a gap between our values and our interests, because it's like, oh, we have these values, we aspire to them, but we have to make a calculation about right now what we need to do. And and I get it. But I also think there are ways to be pragmatic and also consistent. And at some times we try to pull our interests more in alignment with our values. Mm-hmm. Other times we decide we're just going to modify our values to match what we calculate our interests to be.
Yes.
But the issue is that values are like supposed to be kind of timeless.
Evergreen.
And interests change, right?
Yep.
Like the calculus is always changing. So there's that natural tension and struggle, but like I'm basically going off on a PhD thesis right now, but I think that the gap between them is the space of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Because it's where, you know, it's where we struggle. And I think it's what we're trying to figure out as we try to make this experiment of democracy and a pluralistic society really work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I get really discouraged and just think like, oh my God, I'm just going to open an alpaca farm, that would be better than like engaging on any of these issues, because I'm one person and I don't know what I can possibly do.
Yep.
I remind myself that, you know, there's work to be done, but even a small good thing is a good thing.
Oh, I love that, Kate. A small good thing is a good thing. I do think, like this term gets used so much, but scaling.
Mm-hmm.
Make it scalable.
Yeah.
And I think, a challenge that I have found for myself in the policymaking space is that you're often sitting at like, I don't know, so high up, 30,000 feet, 100,000 feet. You're like, you're just way up in the clouds thinking in general terms about your interests and your values. And if you work in that space for, I don't even think you need to be working in that space that long, but it can be hard to remember that there is so much value in individual level interaction, interpersonal interaction, and that is actually, in my experience, that's actually what the civil service is a bunch of humans bumping into each other every day. And that's how the policy gets made. You reinforce through that ongoing discussion internally and hopefully, you know, democratically with the American people.
Yeah.
You reinforce your values to then identify where your interests should lie.
That's why it's really hard work.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, like, is there anything that you think that people misunderstand about public servants? But I feel like what we've just said here really kind of sums it up. Like, it is such hard work.
Yeah.
And you don't just go to work every day and say like, I'm going to achieve this objective. Like, it is constant negotiation. Even people who aren't working on formal international negotiations are negotiating internally nonstop. And I think it requires such emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And so many other skills that are maybe difficult to quantify and difficult to list on a resume, which I think a lot of federal employees who now find themselves displaced are going to find really challenging. I hope maybe through these conversations, we can also kind of help people come up with ideas for how to translate those skills. Because as we said, like, these are some of the most brilliant, dedicated, resilient, emotionally bright human beings that we have. And so I think they're going to do great things. And maybe we will all benefit as a society from the cross-pollination of public and private sector skill sets, right?
I hope so. I could say more about, we should also hope that our institutions remain in some fashion that when that cross-pollination happens, it's for reasons that aren't because we're just being dismantled. But anyway.
That is for sure. Maybe that's where we should end, because let's like just put an exclamation point on that.
Yeah.
But listen, you are such a bright spirit. And honestly, we are so lucky to have had your brilliance and your kindness contributing to the betterment of our country through all the different jobs that you've done. And I want to thank you sincerely for taking the time to sit down with me. And thank you for your friendship. And thank you for your service.
Kate, I have to say the same equally for you. Your service has been an inspiration to me. And now this project, I'm really grateful that you're making space for folks to share their stories. I think even if we weren't in this current moment, there's so much misunderstood about the inner workings of the government, but I hope that folks come away feeling like the civil service is really, it's very human. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of good folks trying to do good work. So thanks, Kate.
Thank you for being here.